Hi there again, everybody. It is once again discussion panel on the Who Goes There podcast, and I have to confess that the idea for this podcast was not original to me. But seeing how it is currently Lent at this time that we're recording, we thought it would be appropriate to bring a discussion of Midnight Mass, which is a horror drama kind of on Netflix. Seven episodes, Mike Flanagan. And joining me for this discussion, I have two previous guests and one new face. So I'm going to say hi to the rest of the panel. So Scott Danielson, hi.
Thanks for having me here.
And you previously joined me on the podcast, and you have a podcast of your own.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do a podcast with my friend Julie Davis. It's called A Good Story is Hard to Find.
And it is excellent.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. Really been enjoying that.
And then we have Mandy. Hi, Mandy.
Hi, Seth.
So who are you and what do you do?
My name is Mandy. I used to have a podcast. It still exists, theoretically, at Trivially Crucial with my friend Michael Gabriel. But it's kind of silent right now. I had a baby recently, so there's not a lot of time.
Nice. I'm going to be doing an episode catching up with Michael pretty soon as well.
Good.
Yeah. So I'll come back to you in just a second to talk about kind of what we're doing here. But first, I want to say hello to Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, my name is Rachel. This is my first podcast, and I work with Mandy. And I remember her coming in to work one day and was like, Rachel, you need to watch this show. And so we've just been talking about this like nonstop since that day. So that's why she invited me to come talk about the show with you all.
Perfect. Okay, so Mandy, what are we doing here exactly? What was the idea? Where did this come from?
So where this came from was I love horror shows, and I particularly love Mike Flanagan's work. So when Midnight Mass came out, I watched it, and then as I tend to do, I rewatched it. and then I just wanted to talk to people about it, and I think I was rewatching it this summer after the baby was born, you know, where you're doing that thing where you're like feeding the baby and watching random shows at 3 a.m. And I just wanted to talk to all the people I know who loved it. And so I was texting Rachel about it. I was tweeting Seth about it. And I was like, it would be great if we, like, there are so many themes and interesting things to talk about in the show. And I would love to talk about it. And all the people I was talking about it with were Protestants. And I was like, it would be great if somebody knew a Catholic we could talk about it with, which is where how we got our fourth here today.
Yes, thank you for inviting me. I'm excited. I love this show. And I loved it. You know, when Seth contacted me, I was like, oh, heck yeah, I'd love to talk about it.
Nice.
Yeah so it might be good maybe just to, you know, first off, I want to say we are clearly going to be spoiling Midnight Mass. There is... Yes. This is like all holds barred. There's no secrets. So
it's been out for what, 2 years?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. So if you haven't watched Midnight Mass, I'm going to highly recommend it. Even if you don't like horror, I'm going to recommend it.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Yeah.
Though I could not convince my husband to watch it or Michael, who both dislike horror. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. See, I got my wife to watch it, and we're not really big horror fans. I'm not a big horror fan. I've watched a few movies recently just because my son's gotten more into it, and I like to, you know, watch stuff that he's watching. Mm-hmm. But this is very much, it's a drama, right? There are some horror elements to it, but it's a drama. And people might be going, if it's a horror show, why aren't we doing this at Halloween? And we were thinking about doing it at Halloween, but all, you know, schedules and everything kind of didn't work for that. And so Mandy sent out an email and said, hey, we've missed Halloween. So how about Lent? You know, how about near Easter? We could do it because the show is really set around that holiday. And it's an important, super important day on the liturgical calendar. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's great that we have Scott here to talk about some of that.
For sure.
Because there's some significant things that happen. I definitely give it a hearty recommendation, even if you're not really into horror. It's so well done and it's such a good drama that I think, you know, as long, if you don't mind a little bit of spooky something, then you'll be okay. If you're complete wuss, I've always considered myself a complete wuss, and I still love this.
Heck yeah. I loved it too. And I think the horror elements, I mean, they're there, but it's not the most horrifying show ever. It's more of a sinister, kind of a spiritual, slow burn kind of a thing, which I loved. I just, 7 episodes long, about an hour each.
Yeah, and I will say, if you've seen any of the other Mike Flanagan stuff, which if you're not a horror fan, you probably have not watched Haunting of Hill House, which I finally did watch, Mandy, by the way. Mm-hmm.
Did you love it?
I did. I do think it's scarier than Midnight Mass.
Yes, I agree.
Oh, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rachel, you came to this because Mandy told you had to.
So, I mean, no, not really. We've been talking about it because she came in and she's, like I said, she came into work and she's like, Rachel, you need to watch this show. And I was like, okay, I'll go watch it. And she had actually gotten me to watch Haunting of Hill House first. And I absolutely loved it. Okay. Like, I loved it.
Yeah.
So when she said, you have to watch this show, I was like, okay, well, she was really like, that was true about Haunting of Hill House. So I'll watch the show. And then, yeah, I was hooked after like the first 2 episodes, like what's going on. And I really loved the, the spiritual aspect to it because I felt like it represents it represents several different belief systems, but I appreciated how it represented the Christian belief system too. Like, I mean, a lot of different shows have they're really biased. And so like, if it's more atheist based or humanist based, it's like, oh, well, the Christians are just idiotic, ill-informed, like, they kind of write them off as ridiculous. If it comes from a Christian perspective, they do the same thing to other religions or other viewpoints. And I don't know, it was really refreshing to see in this show that I felt like they equally represented each of the religious aspects or the religious viewpoints equally across the show. So I really appreciated that. And I found it refreshing, especially in like a horror genre, to see a show do that.
Yeah. Sort of the, Mandy, you had sent out like 3 things that you wanted to talk about on this. Like one was just fawning over the show and talking about how great it is.
Yeah. So I sent out a list of like impossible topics for us to actually cover in a reasonable amount of time. But you know, I really wanted to talk about the show, the themes of, I'm trying to find that email where I said,
yeah, Rachel mentioned some of it, right? The various discussions of belief systems.
I wanted to talk about the different portrayals of faith, like Rachel mentioned, because this show, I would say there's probably like 4 different things represented, which is Catholicism, obviously. You have a mass is in the title, right? Mm-hmm. You know, atheism, you have one character who is a former Catholic who has gone away from everything. You have 2 Muslim characters. And then I feel like there are probably a couple of characters who are more agnostic than they are faithful. But, you know, but all of those faiths are, as Rachel said, represented in good faith, if you will, to those belief systems. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about is ultimately, I feel like this is a show about cults and toxic religion. So I really wanted to talk about how people use faith to control people, and how even people who are sincere, can lead people astray and or be manipulated by people who are using it to control people, which we'll see in the characters of Father Pruitt and Bev specifically, because I believe Father Pruitt is sincere, if crazy. Misguided is probably the better word, but you know, at some point you're just like, oh my gosh, guy. Whereas, you know, you have a character like Bev who is using her faith and the word and the traditions of her faith to manipulate people. And so I kind of wanted to talk about the different verses she uses and misuses. And then there's a 4th thing, which is, since we have a Catholic on, is, you know, I have some questions about like how the show is representing Catholicism. And there are some things in the show that happen that I'm just like, is there like a deeper level here that I'm not tracking? Because, you know, I'm a Protestant who was raised in the Baptist variety. So we have like zero tradition.
Right. Other than being very quiet in church.
You know, you can sing, you can shout your hallelujahs, but there's no, Baptists really eschew like kind of Lent even. We didn't do right. Lent growing up. That wasn't something we talked about. You just had Easter, right? You had Palm Sunday and Easter. Also, I have opinions about the fact that they skipped Palm Sunday, but so yeah, once again, these are probably way too many topics to talk about in, you know, 1 hour, however long we're here. And I was thinking about it more and I was like, well, how do we address all of these things? As I think we should take it character by character, because that'll give us an opportunity to talk about the different faith aspects, and you know, how they misuse or insincere or are led astray, by the situation, unless someone else has a better idea of how to get through all this meaty subject.
That sounds
like a really good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. So we should probably start off just, we've given some general thoughts, but if anybody wants to talk a little more in depth about their experience with the show and what they think of it,
sure.
We'll start with Scott.
Yeah, I'd love to. You know, in the first episode, I could tell it was going to be really special. There was a couple things that occurred. The first one is, you know, they had a mass there, right? And then they were commenting on the color he was wearing and things like that. Why is it wrong? And then, so there I was like, oh, this is very interesting. And then the moment that I just like, I was all the way in was when Riley was walking home with, what's her name?
Aaron.
Thank you very much. Yeah. He was walking home with Aaron, and, the conversation that they had outside of the front of her house, where he was, basically saying, you know, I have no purpose at all. I really don't know what to do. And her response to that, that was the first of many great conversations in this show where they, and I thought they were very respectful towards religion of all types, like has been said here, but the conversations were very real and very deep and very thought provoking. And, I was like, yeah, I don't know that I've seen this in a show before. So I was really appreciative and, couldn't wait for the next one, you know. When Father Pruitt and Riley get together in the AA meetings, I was riveted, you know.
Yeah.
Plus the horror elements were awesome. And the whole thing had a little bit of a familiar feel to it to me, because I really like Stephen King. And I think that there is just a lot of very Stephen King-ish stuff going on here. There are, you know, very specific allusions, but there's also just the feel of it. You know, Stephen King could have written this practically, you know, how the characters were deep. And you know, we're on an island, there's a storm on, I mean, we could connect all kinds of Stephen King stories.
Right.
And I knew, you know, whenever someone is reading a book, I think that the directors often have them read something specific. So I always like to see, what is that person reading, you know? And, Stephen King is what, the husband, let's see, Riley's dad, he was reading a Stephen King novel right at the beginning, and which I caught on the second showing, the second time I watched it.
I never caught that. And, you know, in all of my notes, I only ever wrote him down as Dad. I don't even know what his name is.
Very good.
I think I called him Elliot.
I loved it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, talking about the cast probably makes sense, because you do have Henry Thomas, who, you know, for any you know, I grew up in the 80s and you know, he was a big force at that time with E.T. especially.
Yeah.
But if you've seen any other Mike Flanagan shows, you know a third of the cast, because he seems to have favorites.
Yeah.
It's the Flanafam. Mm-hmm.
But they're all tremendous. Hamish Linklater plays Father Paul.
Yeah. And he was amazing. I mean, fantastic all the way through.
Yeah, yeah. Well, everybody, that's the thing about the quality of this. Like, the directing is stellar. The scoring is great, where it keeps, it sets the tone with those just very brief notes from a cello that just be like, oh, that's unsettling. But yeah, the scoring is great.
I love that. I mean, you mentioned the scoring. I can't help but mention the hymns.
Yes.
There are periods where there's hymns, and it's like, deeply affecting. I mean, it was just so stirring. Great.
And then you weave that in with the Neil Diamond, which my dad is a big fan. And like, one of my favorite lines from a movie ever is from What About Bob with Bill Murray, where Dr. Marvin asks him about how he's divorced. And he says, well, there are two types of people in this world, those who like Neil Diamond and those who don't. My ex-wife loved him. That's the way our family was. And so I've always not been a fan, but man, watching this, I was like, oh man, I really dig this. The way the music is deployed from the very beginning, right? Because that's the first thing you have is the scene of the car wreck and with Neil Diamond playing over it. And it manages to be sinister and moving at the same time. So good.
Yeah. And then Riley saying that, "Our Father."
Yes.
And the reaction of the person, the paramedic that was fixing him up.
Right.
Yeah. So it was just great, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like it also sets the tone because one of the major themes I noticed through it is suffering and how each of the different perspectives view suffering. And so, like, the police officer saying that while you're at it, why don't you ask him why he always takes the kids while the other people walk away with scratches? Like, I feel like it kind of just opens up to that conversation that Riley's going to have with Father Pruitt later, talking about why Riley lost his faith and Pruitt explaining why he thinks suffering exists in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some great discussions of the theodicy, right? The why does God allow suffering question.
Yeah,
definitely comes in quite a few times. Mandy, any other opening statements from you about, you know, what you like about the show?
So, like I said, I like almost all of Mike Flanagan's things. I couldn't watch Gerard's Game because it hits too many of my like truly horrifying things that I can't deal with. So that's like the only thing I haven't watched that he did. So I was always going to give it a try. As soon as it dropped, I think I was watching it that weekend. To me, when I watch a Flanagan show, it's always the second watch that tells me how good it actually is. Because, you know, in a horror show, the first time, like the scares, the things going on, like they can pull you through a show. Right. And I feel like all of his other works have disappointments in them. I really like Haunting of Hill House, but the last 5 minutes betrays the entire conceit of the show. I like The Haunting of Bly Manor, but I feel like it meanders. I feel like the ending is amazing and the rest of the show is just like all over the place. And then it's like he took all the lessons learned from those shows, because he's done other movies too, but movies are kind of a different animal, right? But he took learning from doing those shows and he made Midnight Mass, which is actually something he's been working on for a long time. If you watch some of his other works, he references Midnight Mass a lot. So if you watch, I can't remember the name of the movie, Hush, maybe, that stars his wife who plays Erin in this. She's actually writing Midnight Mass in that show. She's an author and she's writing Midnight Mass. And there's a whole conversation, like in the first 30 minutes between her and the actress who plays Bev about Erin and Riley in Midnight Mass. It's very funny in retrospect. But, you know, this is something he had been working on for a long time. And I think you can tell it really holds up. Like, I think I've watched it upwards of 5 times now. And every time I watch it, I just think, I wish this was a novel because I want to sink into it. Like, I just want to live in this world, like with these characters. It is so well done. Like, there are a few, you know, on multiple rewatchings, there might be a few questions where you're like, well, how did this happen? Right. But you forgive them because everything else is so amazing. So I'm a book person. So to me, the highest compliment I can give something is I wish it was based on a book so I could go read the book. Right. I just think it is so good. And it deals with such deep themes, which I think is what horror is for, right? Horror is not for cheap, torture porn. It's for dealing with like the elements of life that truly are problematic is the wrong word, but the things that truly disturb us, right? Like, why does God allow suffering? Why does death happen? You know, these are things like that this whole show is about. This show is about fear of death and suffering. And that is like the ultimate human condition, right? Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, the show, the episodes are titled, right? Book one, book two, book three. So mm-hmm. it kind of leans into that literary feel to it. And I love the fact that it's seven episodes.
Yes.
Right? It's not six. It's not eight. I think if you added another episode, it would lose its momentum, but it's,
I agree.
The pacing is so good. And you know, I did see some complaints from people saying it's just people sitting around talking. And yeah, that's what a lot of it is. But if those discussions don't pull you in, then I don't know what you're looking for in your fiction, because they're just so good.
Well put.
So when do you want to get to the questions for Scott, kind of as we go through the characters?
I think as we go through the characters, I think they'll come up, right? Okay. So character-wise, we should probably start with the first character we see, which is Riley.
Yeah. And let's reiterate before we start this, you know, all spoilers, everybody.
Spoilerific, yeah.
If we have enticed you to watch it at this point, go do it. It will take you an entire day to binge if you want to do it in one day. but that's another thing about the format, right? It's insanely bingeable. Where it ends, you know, just leads you. You're like, okay, well, I got to see what happens next. So let's talk. Let's start with Riley, Matt Saracen from Friday Night Lights. I don't even know the actor's name.
I have never watched Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, oh, it's good stuff.
The actor's name is Zach Guilford. I have it in front of me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great, great, great job by him too.
Yeah, so the show starts off with him having killed someone in drunken driving, and he goes to prison.
Yeah, with a car with the Jesus fish on the car.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he was a good Catholic, we learned, right? He was an altar boy. He thought he was doing everything right. Then he seems like he went to college and kind of went off the rails. Becomes an alcoholic, kills a girl, and then he becomes our representative atheist in this show, who's really struggling with everything and faith and belief. And I just want to say right off the bat, like, this is spoiler territory. The gall of Mike Flanagan to kill the person you think is the main character, like, halfway through the show. Like, when that happened, I was like, what?
That was a surprise. That was powerful stuff, though.
And even before you meet Riley's mother, you get a little sense of her in the gift, in the Bible that she sends him, right? Where she writes a verse in there. And Mandy, I went through and I wrote down all the scripture verses.
So did Rachel.
Yeah. And, you know, she writes a little inscription in the Bible about Joseph in prison, right? That he won favor with the guard.
Yeah.
So you know that, there's something about her that you get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, going back to misuse of Bible verses and context, like, you know, once again, it's not that you can't take comfort in any verse in the Bible, but I could imagine that Riley, looking at that, he's like, I'm not Joseph. Joseph did nothing wrong, right? And Riley is very aware that he, for lack of a better word, sinned, right? That he did something truly horrifying. He killed a girl. I don't think we're given her exact age, but I would say under 20, right? Someone at the beginning of her life. And he killed her.
Right.
And he's haunted by her too.
Very, very much so. I mean, literally. Mm-hmm. And the scariest part for me, like the thing that made me jump the most, was her appearances. You start to be able to see when he lays down on his bed, you start to see the flashing lights. And that lets you know you're about to see her. And once I picked up on that, she didn't scare me so much.
Yes.
And it's a jump scare, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rachel, do you have any thoughts on Riley?
What strikes me about him is he just always seems so lost and so hopeless. Yeah. And it just, I don't know, it strikes me every time. Like, I don't know, that's really the thing. Like, every time he talks, I'm just sitting there, I'm like, wow, he literally feels like he has no purpose. I feel like that he feels cursed that he gets to live while Tara Beth doesn't. And he, like, that's his punishment, is living the rest of his life, even though he shouldn't be alive, type of thing.
Yeah. And then I think that he finds his purpose somewhere along the way there, and then does the right thing there at the end, at the end of his life anyway, in that powerful moment. And that ended up allowing her to know what she needed to know in order to kill that thing at the end, right? You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, Rachel and I were actually talking about this recently, that I don't know if Riley made the right decision or not. I think in the end he would have had to die, obviously, but he chooses to end his life instead of staying and fighting. And while on the one hand, I think it's the thing that made Riley unable to... So this is spoiler territory, so we're just going to throw it out there, right? Vampires. Mm-hmm. So Riley gets turned into a vampire. And unlike other folks, he doesn't go on a murder rampage, right? And it's because Riley actually knows what it feels like to have killed someone. And so he cannot do it again. And I do believe that is why he kills himself.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the impression I got too. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, if Riley hadn't killed himself, if he had just told Aaron, you know, Aaron wouldn't have believed him. She would have dragged him to the doctor anyway, saying Riley is crazy. Sarah would have been like, well, actually, look at this blood and what it's doing, which would have substantiated his story. And I think he could have participated in Easter's shenanigans and horror by stopping things from happening. And he could have been on the side of good, much like his parents ended up being that night. Right. And maybe if he had, maybe more people who weren't vampires would have lived. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe.
Could be. You know, and I think, you know, from his alcoholic background, perhaps he felt that he was not going to be able to resist the urge to feed, you know.
Yeah. He even says it, right? I can feel it. Right. Mm-hmm. I think he recognizes his own weakness. And like, this is the only thing that I can do. Mm-hmm. And he clearly doesn't want to do it, right? Where at the end, you know, you can see the regret on his face when he tells her that he loves her and says, I did my best.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about Zach Guilford's face that is very expressive. And the conversations he's having with Aaron, mm-hmm. particularly after she loses the baby, I love the way he just sits with her. And you can see that he's crushed as well, because he loves her, and he's just being empathetic to her. And then when she's talking about her view of what happens when we die, the look on his face is just, and he says it afterwards, right? I really hope you're right. So I think it's a beautiful performance.
I loved the scene. I think it was a good moment for him in this scene where he's there with Pruitt and Joe at the AA meeting.
Mm.
And he says, I don't have anything else to add to this, you know, and then Pruitt lets him have it. And he's just like, no, I can't accept that. You have something to say to this person that no one else can. Yeah. And I think that prefigures what comes later too. But, but that was a good moment for him to, it was a changing point for him.
Right.
I agree. He becomes incredibly invested in Joe. Right. And that is the turning point for the plot and his whole character. Right.
Yeah.
Because when Joe doesn't show up to a meeting, I think Riley wants it to work for Joe, because if it can work for Joe, it can work for him. Right. Yeah. Even though Riley is much further along in his sobriety, he needs to believe that people who have done terrible things, because Joe isn't just a drunk, he's a drunk who's done something terrible.
Right.
He needs to believe that they can come back. Mm-hmm. Right. And when Joe goes missing, Riley's not willing to let things lie.
Yeah.
And I think that is a glimpse, like Rachel said, Riley is so hopeless through the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. Right. And him and his doggedness about Joe, I think, is that glimpse of his true personality without the coming back, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Having an actual sense of purpose. To help Joe, and then unfortunately that doesn't work out for him.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I do have to say that you know, the suicide that he does, you know, it is bothersome. You know, I just wanted to make sure that was out there, you know, that to feel so hopeless that you just can't go on, or that, you know, this seems his best option. you know, I can only assume that he didn't think that he could deal with it. He right. didn't think that he was going to be able to not kill somebody, and he couldn't face that. That's what I think happened there.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, in terms of the Catholic views on suicide and euthanasia and capital punishment, all that kind of stuff, definitely weighs into that idea, right? If you're a vampire and the alternative is let yourself be consumed by the sun or consume people, I can kind of give him a pass on the suicide part of it. But to me, it seems more like he's sacrificing himself than committing suicide. It's like he's jumping right. on a grenade.
Agreed.
The grenade is yeah. the sun.
Yes. Yeah. I feel that same way.
Riley, like I said, is an atheist, right? But I do mm-hmm. think it's interesting because the show gives him premonitions.
Yes.
So I don't know what the show is saying about the truth or the reality of the world or whatever. But it's not just that he dreams of himself being on the boat, because there's a lot of things you could rationalize about that. Mm-hmm. He has very clear dreams that involve the church with bloody handprints that we see. Mm. later.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Riley is very clearly getting premonitions of what is to come. So the show, it's interesting because I think my understanding is Flanagan grew up Catholic and is no longer Catholic, is probably atheist or agnostic. But it's interesting that he adds that little, like, there is still supernatural in the world, and not just in the form of vampires. Because once again, you could rationalize vampires however you want. Sarah certainly does right. in the show. But Riley's premonitions, you know, is it a gift of prophecy? You know, is it he just has some connection? I don't know. So I wanted to throw it out there. What do you guys think about Riley's scene of the future?
I don't know. So the thing that I don't know, that kind of I've been thinking about over the last few days is the topic of whether or not you lose your salvation. And even though Riley's kind of turned his back on God since his experience in prison and whatnot, I guess the question is, like, did he actually lose his salvation? And does he still have, I guess, like, spiritual gifts, even though he's not in an active relationship with God at the moment? So I don't know. That's something that I've been kind of mulling over, and I haven't quite come to a conclusion yet, but just throwing that out there.
I love that thought. I love that thought. You know, I think, you know, God's grace, you know, this offer of divine friendship never, ever, ever goes away. No matter what state you're in, it's always there. You just need to take the hand. Right. So, you know, it's, you know, as far as, you know, what kind of a state he's in, you know, I can certainly see what, you know, God can still operate, you know, and God does. Right. So, yeah, it's, you know, I think it's like, you know, Riley was going to be in the right places at the right times, and he needed things in order to be able to process that at the right time in order for him to do the things that he needed to do. And God was operating that way in him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And related to that, you bring up the point, Riley and Father Pruitt have a very interesting discussion after Riley gets turned into a vampire, right? Mm, what does Father Pruitt call it? Like, the most important AA meeting of his life. Right. Father Pruitt gives him this lecture that, you know, everything in his life was for the purpose so he could be here at this time. And thinking about it, I don't think Father Pruitt is wrong. He's just wrong about the purpose for which Riley is there. Yeah. Right. This goes back to suffering and even Joseph in jail, mm-hmm. right? Like, Joseph being in jail in the Bible was not a good thing for him personally. But, you know, God was able to use that to save Israel, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially in the end. Riley, I don't think God wanted him to kill Terah Beth. But after that terrible thing happened, God was able to put Riley in a position to, because he had actually killed someone, which nobody else on the island before the show had done, he was able to take a stand that nobody else was able to take. right? And Father, which goes back when we talk about Father Pruitt, there's so much that's like, mm-hmm. there are sections where it's like, he is so right for the wrong reason, mm-hmm. right? and it's a mm-hmm. very interesting. Seth, do you have anything to add on Riley?
I mean, I think it's a great point that you make about the fact that he's someone who has killed someone puts him into a unique position of being able to resist, you know, not wanting to experience that again. And, you know, just having come from a place where not just that he killed someone, but that he did something that he perceives as unforgivable, right? He accepts the punishment, right? 4 years, it ends up being 4 years in prison, right? And he knows mm-hmm. that that's not enough. And so that's when he comes back home, he's like, I don't know what my purpose is here. I'm just supposed to exist. And ultimately, by making the choice to no longer exist, he's trying to push Aaron in the right direction to preserve many lives, to bring it back to Joseph, right? I was sent ahead of you to preserve life. It's yes. a different, mm. definitely a different take on the way Joseph does things.
But I love it. I did hear an interview of Mike Flanagan, and the interviewer asked him, which character was in your mind when you started? You know, what was the thing that kicked it off? And for him, it was Riley.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was just interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Who should we talk about next, Mandy?
I don't know. I feel like we got to save Father Pruitt for last because everything ties into him.
We might be able to do, you know, shorter discussions on a few of the other minor characters, or we can just go straight to Aaron.
Yeah. So we can go straight to Aaron, to me, Aaron, while she goes to church and do those things, I feel like she just has a little bit more of a flavor of, maybe agnostic or just kind of culturally Christian, like not to say that she doesn't believe, right? But just kind of the way she talks about things and kind of the conclusion she comes to in the end. I just feel like she's not, not to say that she's not a believer, but right. She's not maybe as devout as, say, Riley's parents or something like that, right? Yeah. And so when we meet Aaron, she's a teacher at the school. She is from the island. She ran away from the island. She ended up in an abusive relationship, and she escaped that when she discovered she was pregnant. And she came back to the island to live in her mother's house. Her mother is dead. Her mother, it also seems like, abused her. Mm-hmm. And so she kind of has this bad past, but her and Riley were friends growing up, and they're becoming friends again. A lot of this information is not given to you at the beginning, right? It's doled out over time. And while at the beginning, it seems like Riley is our main character and Aaron is a little more just of a side, you know, love interest, she becomes pivotal in the end. So, Aaron.
I remember in that first conversation that Riley and Aaron have, that she says, isn't this amazing that we've switched roles, you know? And when you just said that she kind of becomes the main character at the end, I mean, you didn't use those words, but then they switched roles. They switched roles after the boat, didn't they? Interesting.
Yeah. And she becomes, like, if you think of a protagonist in a traditional sense, which is the person who drives the plot forward, who's making the decisions that change things, she becomes that person, right? Because she's the one who gathers the team, if you will, right? She's the one who tries to make the plan of getting everyone off island. And then when that doesn't go to what's supposed to, you know, they go back to the team and they make decisions. I think she's the one who says first that she's going to go to Easter service. Sarah and Millie look at her like she's a little bit crazy. Right. But she's like, everyone I love is going to be there.
That's really interesting in contrast with what we were talking about with Riley, because she could have left. Right. You know, which is kind of what Riley did. Yes. Right. But she's like, no, I have to go there because there might be something I can do.
And I think that's what Riley wanted her to do, too.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a great point.
And she has reasons to be equally hopeless, right? Which isn't to say she murdered someone and went to jail, but she just lost her baby that all of her hopes and dreams and like gave her a new purpose in life, right?
Like the reasons left her for her decisions up to that point were the baby, weren't they? Yeah. The reason that she was there in the first place was that baby. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because that's the one good thing coming out of this awful period of her life, right? The beauty for ashes kind of, she's, I have this wonderful child now. Even though, you know, I had to suffer to get there, and then that's taken away.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, you know, thematically in the show, because this just shows that, you know, Father Pruitt is wrong, right? Is it's the miracle that takes the baby from her.
Right.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Because her body heals it, right? So it goes away. And I don't think Father Pruitt ever knows that or puts that together. But it just shows us that this miracle, if you were on the fence before this,
right.
You should not be on the fence now.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask Scott that I had written down, you know, a major plot point in this is, of course, that the communion wine has this sacrament in it, is what Father Paul calls it. How common is it to receive in both elements?
Before COVID, it was the way we did it all the time. But it's like, you know, we have the body of Christ, and pretty much everybody does that. And then if you choose to, you can take wine or the blood of Christ as well. Yeah. So it was always offered. We haven't gone back to that since COVID, but I think that after Easter we will be. But I'm sure that there are parishes all over the world that are back doing it.
And is it a common cup?
Yep, it is.
It's portrayed here. Okay. Yeah, I can definitely see why during COVID. Mm-hmm.
So I also have a question relating to communion. Mm-hmm. So I'll just throw it in here, even though I was going to save it for Father Pruitt. But so there's a scene where Father Pruitt is refilling the, there's a fancy word for it. The cruet, yes, from a flask, and Warren catches him. And I guess my question is, you know, to me, that would be shocking. But is it blasphemous? Like what level of shocking is this?
No, it wouldn't be blasphemous at that point, you know, because it's wine, you know, it hasn't been consecrated. So, it's like, you know, when we fill the cruets, you know, we're filling it out of a bottle, you know, we buy wine in gallon, you know, at our parish, you may buy, you know, you have a gallon of wine and then you fill the cruet with that. For the altar boy just to be thinking, oh, he just doesn't think it's full enough, and he's, you know, putting that in there, wouldn't be abnormal, you know, because it's just wine at that point. And then when it's consecrated, that's when, you know, we'll consume all of that. We don't put that away somewhere, you know.
Right.
So maybe the level of shock is just supposed to be that Warren thinks now that
Father Pruitt's like, he would think, oh yeah, Father's got a flask of wine on him all the time, is what he's thinking. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Rachel, did you have any thoughts on Aaron?
I think something I found interesting, because I've been listening to a podcast about cults, and that there's like essentially two ways that you can come out of a cult. And one is if you find Jesus and you pursue that path, or you're just turned off to religion in general. And I feel like near the end, Aaron kind of goes that path of she's just kind of turned off to religion in general. And so I kind of agree with what you said, that she's kind of like a cultural Christian. Like, I mean, she could believe, but especially seeing that what she had placed her faith in took her baby, I think she kind of comes out of that as like, nope, I don't know what the right way is. Obviously, this is not the right way. And I think that kind of leads into her little monologue when she's dying, which I personally don't really like that much. It seems very new agey, but I know it's Mike Flanagan and he doesn't have the same like views on death as I would have. So I can't really complain about that. But I think that kind of plays into how she views death after, because I think when she left, she considered this, I mean, she thought this was real and then it wasn't real. And now she's just completely turned off to religion in general.
Mm-hmm. A couple of favorite moments of Aaron for me are when Bev says, look, if you shoot me, you're just, you know, I'll be back up in 5 minutes. And without hesitation, she just blows her away. Says, we have 5 minutes. And then I also love I think it's after Riley goes back to the mainland for his first AA meeting. And he comes back and he's talking with Aaron about, you know, how is your day? And they're comparing, you know, would you want to trade your day with me? And she talks about morning system and being slut shamed by Bev and all this other stuff. And it's just so well done.
Yeah.
And I mean, we'll talk about Bev later, but Bev like shaming Aaron for being a married woman who's pregnant.
Well, but she's estranged from her husband, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. Yes, but she didn't have a child out of wedlock, right? Like, she got married. She left her husband because she's pregnant. Like, I'm just like, Bev.
Yeah. Come on, Bev.
I'm sure that to Bev, she didn't do it right, right? She probably didn't get married in the church, which, you know, not being married in the church would make it an invalid union, I believe. Anyway, Scott, you can, I guess, as long as the proper forms were observed.
Yeah. So we have the sacrament of marriage. And if you want to be married in the church would mean that you go through the sacrament of marriage.
Yeah.
And then some people don't. Right.
Yeah.
But you should, if you're married, you should have the sacrament. It's one of the seven sacraments. Yeah. So you're right. Yeah.
Right.
Would what's the word I'm looking for? Someone who's lawful. What's the word I'm looking for?
Lawful.
Like, man. Bev. She's legalist? Like lawful evil, right? Legalist. would someone who's as legalist as Bev then say that because Aaron wasn't married in the church and didn't do the sacrament, therefore she's
that's
not really
exactly
married?
That's exactly what she would say. Yeah. Yes. She would say that's no good and you didn't do it right. No question.
Interesting.
That she was essentially never really married.
Right.
So from Bev's perspective, then it is a child out of wedlock, regardless.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. She would be frowny.
Bev's going to be frowny about everything.
Bev's going to be frowny.
That's pretty much her whole character.
Yeah, for sure.
So I feel like that is a nice segue into Bev if we want to go there next. Because if we have if we have an antagonist who's not the vampire or Father Pruitt.
Oh, no, she's the main villain of the show.
Yeah, no, she's the villain.
She is definitely the main villain of the show. So Bev is she's our incredibly legalistic, Catholic leader. So before we got too much into that, I wanted to ask Scott, when did women become allowed to do what Bev is doing for the church?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, women have all kinds of positions. We don't have women deacons, and she's not a deacon, but there are all kinds of people that, you know, serve in ministry that are women. You know, we ministry is not like giving sermons and things. We call them homilies, you know, so women are not doing that. But as far as assisting, being Eucharistic ministers in that small little town, you know, I've had at our local church until fairly recently when she retired, we had a nun that was, you know, doing a lot of the functions that Bev was doing. It's basically she was doing management, you know. And she would just wear an alb, you know, during Mass. She wasn't wearing any, you know, deacon designations or anything like that.
Vestments of any kind.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So she was really, you know, managing. I don't know what you would call her official position, but, you know, we have...
I get the impression that before Monsignor Pruitt went away... She was still in charge, essentially. I mean,
formally. She's in charge, right? Yeah. And, you know, serving the priest is how it should be, right?
That's how it should
but
be.
But as Monsignor Pruitt was deteriorating, she was probably becoming more and more powerful.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Which clearly she was when she, I guess she was the one who built the rec center. Or, you know, they say that during the show where she was pulling the money in and getting that done. And I'm sure she was feeling quite powerful in town.
Yeah. And so, and that's, there is one question that I have for everybody when we get there, and maybe I should just say it now so I don't forget, because I'm famous on podcasts for saying, I want to talk about this later and then not talking about it later. Because with her having that power, then when this young priest comes back in and she doesn't realize immediately, but she does realize pretty quickly who he
that
really
is. Him. Yes.
He is a threat to her position at some point.
Yes.
And then when the things that happen with him happen, she uses that to launch herself into a new dimension as well, because now she is propping up this guy. And that's why I say she's the true villain, right? Because Father Pruitt doesn't want to do evil, but he does some evil things. And then Bev helps him cover them up and wash them over.
You know. Well, it's really interesting because I realized it on this rewatch is that it was Easter service is Bev's idea. like having everyone take the poison and convert that night. That Jonestown moment is her idea. Father Pruitt was not thinking that. He might have been thinking, you know, to reveal the truth of himself on Easter and the miracle of that. But she's the one who's like, Easter has always been a day of baptism, which is true. You know, in the ancient church, right, a lot of times baptisms were saved for Easter and they just did a ton on Easter.
And the Easter vigil is huge.
We still do that, yeah. If there's an adult coming into the church, we bring them in at Easter vigil.
Right. Got all the way through RCIA. Know that.
Learned something new.
Yep, exactly.
I had never put that together before, but I don't want to blame her for all of Father Pruitt's wrong decisions because clearly he has mental faculties now, right?
Yes.
But she is leading him astray at every opportunity she has, and it's to consolidate her power.
Yes.
And it's just so interesting. Like when she finds him and he's killed Joe, right? He's in shock. I don't think, you know, when she's like, do you feel guilt or not? Like, whatever that is, like, he's in shock. That's why he's not feeling anything. He doesn't understand what happened. He's struggling with it. And she pushes him into, like, don't be shocked about this. It's all cool. Right.
Yeah.
There's just so many times where he's come to a crossroads and she pushes him in the wrong direction. And it's so interesting.
Yeah, it really is interesting. And I love that you call her legalistic, you know, and we see that in her again from that very first time when, you know, right after the mass with, they called him Paul Hill at the moment, right? Mm-hmm. But she said, you're wearing the wrong color. And she's like, can you explain that to me? You know, so she's, you know, that legalism is just right there, you know? And that, by the way, that is a Catholic thing. We have this liturgical year. And we have what was called ordinary time, and then we have Lent, and they wear green in ordinary time and purple in Lent. And then that gold or white that he wears is for a special occasion. So, but the priest knew that he knew the colors, right? He to him, this was a special occasion. He was doing it, saying that was the indication there that this is something special that's happening.
Yeah.
He didn't wear green. But I think that's, you know, that's her character and this, she must have been, like we said, extremely powerful on the island, had a position of respect, you know, at least in her own eyes.
Yes.
And, I love what you said that when the young person comes in, she's threatened by that. But then when things start to fall apart or become apparent, she is reacting in a way that does give her the power. And that is super, super interesting. You know, it's, you know, something that's happened in religion all the time, right? You know, power corrupts, you know, people get powerful and they do stupid things. But she just seems to be drunk on that. And you can tell, you know, like when she killed the dog, you know, that was really well done. I don't even think that it's, I mean, you guys all agree that she killed the dog, right?
Yeah.
This was getting to the question that I said I was going to say. And then
okay.
I didn't.
Please go ahead. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask. We all agree she killed the dog, right?
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So Rachel, do you want to explain why you know she killed the dog?
So when it shows the dog and the hot dog comes down, you can see the corner of a dress with the pattern on it and everything. And you don't see whose hand it is. You don't see anything else. You just see the hem of a dress. And then I like on my second rewatch, I was just like, okay, now I need to pay attention to what Bev is wearing. And it's the same pattern. So it's definitely her that gives the hot dog to the dog.
Very good.
So this leads into my other question. The actual question I was going to put, did she poison Father Paul?
My answer is no.
Really? Okay. Because I had always assumed that him being a threat to her power, that she was trying to kill him.
So, but when he dies, she looks truly shocked. And I just don't think Bev is a good actress. I mean, the actress is a good actress.
Yeah, right.
The character is not very good at hiding how she feels. Like, you can see at every moment, like, she's not one of those people who's like, super two-faced in the sense that you have no idea what she's feeling, right? Everyone in the town knows what Bev is like. She is not hiding anything. And she knew at that point, she knew before he died that it was Father Pruitt, right? And while he was a threat to her, I don't think she killed him, because when you watch that scene, she just seems so surprised. So I think there are two leading theories that I have. One of which is that she was, in fact, putting out poison in her yard. The vampire was drinking animals who had drank the poison, and Father Pruitt is drinking large amounts of the blood and sort of secondhand poisoning himself. And then, Rachel, I think you told me something that you said Mike Flanagan said.
Yeah. So in an interview, because I think someone asked him if Bev poisoned Father Pruitt, and he was like, I get that question a lot. People always seem to think that's what happened, and I don't know why. But I guess what he was intending was that Father Pruitt had just drank so much of the vampire's blood that at some point his body just gave up, and so the vampire's blood just kind of overtook Father Pruitt and killed him, and then eventually raised him from the dead, I guess. But that was what Mike Flanagan apparently had in mind when he made that scene.
Which I do think is supported by what Sarah says she's found in the blood, that it is a parasite, right?
Right.
And we've already seen that it killed Aaron's baby. Well, kind of disappeared it, I guess.
Yes. Yeah.
But I do think that's an interesting, it's just like if you drink enough vampire blood, you're going to die either way, which is probably supported by the fact this is why the vampire is not going around killing all the people in mass, right? And turning them into vampires. Cause he knows it's inevitable. It's going to happen.
Yeah. So once they get enough of that in their blood, then they die. And it does look, they do have to drink a vampire's blood. Well, no, is that true? Well, Father Pruitt did though.
Well, so they're drinking the blood in communion mass.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay. Yeah. So when they die, they're going to come back. Yeah. Yes. And eventually, if they continue the way that they were going, eventually they would die. Is, I think, kind of what's implied there.
But I think they're getting so little in the mass, and he has drank so much more than them. But what's interesting is the first time I watched it, when you don't know what's happening, is I thought because he healed Lisa right before that and then he starts getting sick, I was like, did he like transfer his life force to Lisa?
That's that's what I had the same thought. Yeah. That he was sick because he did that. That's kind of
So it's like a misdirection. And it's a really well done misdirection, I think.
Yeah. Very good.
We're still talking about Bev, right?
We are still talking about Bev.
The only reason that I thought that she poisoned Father is that it's because of the way he dies. It looks just like what happened to the dog.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so it seems that the poison was involved there. And, you know, the show focuses on those compound 1080 cans quite a few times. But I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'll have to just watch it again, I guess. I've only watched it three times. So.
Also, can I just say one of my little nitpicks about the show? Well, I have two, I guess, but they're really, I have many, but they're related to the rat poison specifically. You would have to drink a lot of rat poison to kill a full adult. Like, you cannot just drink a little cup. Mike Flanagan seems obsessed with this idea that rat poison works like a cyanide pill. It does not. If you drink a little bit of rat poison, you are not just going to instantly die. And I'm also not convinced that the dog got enough rat poison, because that was a big dog. And I don't know how you could put enough in you put a little bit of rat poison out. Rats are, they're not, you know, 80-pound dogs or 80-pound humans plus.
What we file that under is what TV Tropes calls art major physics.
Yes. And then related to that, if I have to choose a way to die to become back as a vampire, just shoot me. Like, I don't want to take rat poison. Like, that looks like a terrible way to die.
Yes, but it's communion, right? It's evocative of communion.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Very, very good point.
I know, but just line me up against the wall and shoot me. Yeah. Like, I don't.
That's something.
Related to Bev, the fact that she is not the one who takes the first communion that kills you is just so galling, and because it is so indicative of her character. Like if she was truly a true believer in what was happening, it wouldn't have been Sturge who took the first one, right? She would have, so she could have been his first disciple resurrected from the dead and called herself this like first among, you know, the vampires, but she's too afraid. And she hides in the back.
Yes, she was certain enough of it to make somebody else do it.
Yeah, I wonder what her plan was. That I love that you said that because, you know, she was too afraid. And I was wondering, you know, was she afraid or did she have a plan? And if her plan, she had a plan, what was the plan? But she was clearly afraid hiding behind that door when the people that were escaping the chapel, you know, they found her in there. So that she was clearly afraid. But I was just wondering, you know, she's going to sit in there and wait this thing out. And then what? What was she thinking? I mean, I just didn't understand what she thought was going to happen next. Or,
you know. I wonder if she thought she was braver than she was and she thought she was going to drink it. And then when it came to it, she couldn't.
Yeah. I started to think about like a familiar for Dracula. You know, was she thinking that she was going to serve everybody or, you know, I don't know. I was just trying to think of what the heck she was thinking.
I think her faith is misplaced. That's all.
Oh, guaranteed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's true.
She has faith in whatever she thinks is going to give her power and preserve her. And so like when, like she would be okay being a familiar for Pruitt or whatever, because she thinks that gives her power. But I think she's just as terrified of death as Pruitt is, if not more. And so I don't think she could ever bring herself to purposefully put herself in a situation where she was going to die. Like, I think the only reason, like the only time I see her kind of put herself out there is when Pruitt calls her over in front of Riley after he's just been turned. And says, like, here, just stand here. I'll hold him back. And I think the only reason she did that is because she sees Pruitt as an authority. She sees him as a gateway to being an authority. And so she's willing to do what he wants her to do.
Oh, but she was terrified.
So I don't know. That's like, it's her faith is clearly not in God. Yeah, she was terrified, but she did it. Because I think she sees Pruitt as her gateway to being in charge. And so if that's what he wanted her to do, then and that was how she would maintain that path to authority, she's willing to do that.
Yeah, and the ultimate kind of evolution of Bev into controlling everything, you know, she gets to the point where she says to Sturge, why did you bring, you know, this guy hasn't been to Mass in years. What, you know, why did you choose to share this with him? And she says to Father Pruitt, right, we're going to spread the good news to the whole world. Well, who gets to decide that? Well, we do. You know, she is now the gatekeeper of this miracle.
And that's exactly how she viewed the congregation before all this happened, too. There are chosen people and there are not chosen people. And shun the unchosen. Yeah.
Although, perversely, she says, you know, the gates shall never be shut, right?
Right.
Except when I say they should be
shut. Exactly right.
Well, it's interesting because she is so mad that Father Pruitt saved Riley, right?
Yeah.
She is so mad about it. She's like, why him? Why did we save him? She is literally that person who doesn't understand that Jesus came for the sick. Right. And she is so also, I think Rachel hit it on the head when Bev is afraid of death. And I think at the end of the day, she knows that she doesn't actually have faith. Right.
Oh,
she does not
feel
confident.
Yeah. Yes. She's all digging.
She is that the only one in town who tries to hide from the sun. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, and cause she knows that she is, sorry, I am not as Bible snappy as Bev is pulling the verses out. But isn't there a verse that's about like leaders who lead people astray purposefully will get greater punishment? And I feel like Bev knows that because she knows the Bible and she knows what she has done. And so if she truly believes there's an afterlife, if she is an actual believer, like she knows that she is facing judgment, right?
I loved when Riley's mom told her that she was not a good person.
Yes.
That was great. You are not a good person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone needed to tell you.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting. I find it interesting to kind of go along with another theme that I noticed in the series is that they kind of discuss, is anything inherently bad or is it just how people use it? And they kind of talk about alcohol being like, it's not bad. It's just people who misuse it to hurt others or who end up hurting others. That's what makes that bad. And I feel like religion is kind of in the same boat there where like, it's not bad, but it can be abused and used by people to control others or to hurt others, like what Bev is doing. But it in itself is not bad. If you're following, if you're following it, if you're following God, then it's not a bad thing. But like how Bev uses it is bad. That's what makes not religion bad, but how she uses it is bad.
And she uses everything in the island to gain power, right? She used the oil spill to, you know, and the subsidies to get money to build the rec center. I mean, I use quotations, but I guess it's a real rec center. It's just, and then even the storm, right, that's coming, she's like, well, the church must be shelter, right? Which, you know, I've lived in places where churches have been shelters during hurricanes and things like that. But let me tell you, if I need to shelter, I'm not sheltering in that little church made of plywood. Like, I'm pretty sure the school's gonna at least be made from cinder block,
right,
you know, like the churches I've sheltered in have been like buildings that I felt confident weren't going to be blown over. But that little chapel, I do not feel confident in its structural soundness. But it's about power. It's not about keeping people safe. It's about people having to come to her to be safe.
Oh, perfect.
That's probably a good segue between Bev and Sheriff, Sheriff Hassan. Because
Sheriff,
man, he's so good. What is his name? Raul Coley?
I don't know, but I love him.
Yeah, I knew him from iZombie.
He's also in The Haunting of Bly Manor, right?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that one yet. But yes, he is the Muslim character, right? And it has a tragic background. His wife died of pancreatic cancer, and he had kind of turned to their faith through the influence of his wife and is now maintaining that faith with their son, Ali, out of the memory of his wife. And it's beautiful. And I really do love that confrontation that you have, the sort of school board meeting almost, talking about how his son was sent home with a Bible from school, from a public school, and this is not okay. And that's, it's all just a tremendous discussion of assumptions that Bev is making about the way Muslims think of Christianity and the way clearly she thinks of Muslims, and that it all comes, her true colors come out at the very, very end, right? Dirty blood.
Right. I loved that character. How, you know, see, I think the first time we realized that he was kind of in an uncomfortable spot was when all the cats were on the beach and he's walking around and the mayor is there and the mayor starts talking to him about, hey, you ought to come to Mass.
Right.
You know, in the midst of this crisis, you know, he's, you know, you can just imagine he's talked to all the time about how he needs to go to Mass and all this stuff. And, oh, we're just inviting you. You know, it's not, we're not trying to convert you or anything.
Right.
But how he's just dealing with that all the time.
And what's so interesting at that point is that not very many people are going to Mass. So this idea that he needs to go to Mass to meet with the, what is it, 127 people who live in the town. It's like when you see the Mass when Father Pruitt first shows back up, like the Sunday Mass is like maybe 20 people and the morning Mass is like three. Right. And so it's like you're pressuring him to do this thing that not even the whole island is doing. So even if it was like, you need to come for our, you know, potluck, whatever it is, which he does go to the potluck, but you know, like, it's not like the whole town is there. They're not.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and no one ever speaks to him to ask, you know, after him and his family and how, you know, how they're doing other than in that context, right? Maybe you should come to Mass. Someone could have invited him over for a meal.
Though to be fair, he is a sheriff. So, you know, I feel like the mayor and the sheriff can definitely be on equal terms, right? But the sheriff does call Sarah up short at one point for she's never asked after him. And I'm like, I don't know how you guys are around people in positions of authority, but, you know, I get called into my boss's office even when I know I have a promotion and I still feel like I'm in the principal's office and I'm going to get in trouble.
Like, I feel like on an island of 127 people, there should be more of a sense of family, right?
Yeah.
One would hope. Yeah. Though I do want to call out the sheriff for his bad decision-making. You leave the NYPD for racism, and you choose to go to an all-white, all-Catholic island.
Right.
Yeah.
There are better cities or towns, small towns with Muslim populations. I went to high school in Orlando, and you know, 25% of the kids I knew were Muslim. Mm-hmm. Like, there are places you can go where there are other Muslims, you know, I just had to have been desperate for any job, I guess.
Yeah, I think he wanted anonymity in the in the small sense, right? Where he's just away from authorities that are suspicious of Muslims.
So you move to an isolated island.
Right.
Yeah. Which is also not good because he knows his son wants to fit in so badly. Like, he says it multiple times, and he still manages to move to this place that, like, is not going to provide a good foundation for his son or his son's faith or anything like that.
Yeah.
And the other kids are racist to Ali, right? Like, what is the one kid calls him Aladdin.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
Well, and Joe calls the sheriff Sharif, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's devastating, you know, for him to think that he's wanting to explore or possibly convert to Catholicism, not because he's become this believer, but because he wants to fit in.
Yeah.
And that would be devastating. Yeah.
I did like the moment too. That, like, it's a good dad moment where he says, I'm not going to tell my son not to look for God.
Mm-hmm.
I really love the conversation the sheriff and Ali have about suffering.
Yes. It's great.
When he talks about his mother and he says, I cannot believe that God saved Lisa and not your mom. Is essentially what he says. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is, you know, the problem of suffering is something we can write PhD theses on,
sure.
Right? Yeah. Like, people do, you know, the priests and pastors who get their doctorates, you know, they spend a lot of time grappling with these questions, and it is hard, you know, to understand sometimes, why was this person saved? Why does this person get all of these things? Yeah. And I was not, right? Like, why, was, you know, this child born into a family that's going to abuse them, and then this other family can't conceive, right? These are the kinds of questions people have, and they're real. And I love that the show doesn't shy away from those questions. And I, you know, I was talking to Rachel the other day because I was like, I know this show is basically rated R, but I feel like it is a great show that people should watch with their teenage kids, mm-hmm. and use it as a talking point for the, if you're religious, right, to use it as a talking point for these deep theological questions.
Yeah. It's great that they had someone to answer the questions, you know, someone, you know, to give a different point of view, even though it was Pruitt who was, you know, sailing off into the whatever, but it was like, you know, Pruitt had some great answers.
Mm-hmm.
He did.
You know, when he was talking to Riley. Yeah.
One thing I love about the Bible too, is that it preserves those questions. Half the Psalms are laments, you know,
where
the psalmist is saying, why are you acting this way? You know, why are you not closer to me? That the psalmist is asking that of God, right? You have the whole entire book of Job asking why. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that I've always loved about the Bible.
The moral of Ecclesiastes is life sucks and then you die. Like,
what was in my head, yeah. Ecclesiastes.
Yeah. It's like the Bible doesn't shy away from that, but I feel like too often, I feel like this is an American Christian thing, and I feel like you see it in both Catholicism and Protestantism, and it's that influence of prosperity gospel, right, on all of us, which is that we think if God loves you, your life will be great. But nowhere in the Bible is that promised. And you see the people on the island struggling with that because their lives are not going the way they thought it would go. The island is dying. People are moving away and not even selling their homes. Like, they've given up.
Yeah.
Their whole way of life is about to end. And so they're willing to do anything to hold on to it. So when these miracles start happening, right? It's like, it's bringing life to the whole island. And then you have the sheriff and Ali, and to a certain extent, Joe, as these outsiders, right? Who aren't really part of the miracle. But the other kids are pulling Ali in. And it's just so, like, Bev doesn't even know Ali's name at the end. She calls him boy. Mm-hmm. Like to her, he is just a pawn in a game. And it's so galling. Mm-hmm. He's her student and she doesn't know his name. And he's the one non-white kid. Like if you're going to remember anyone's name, it's the one who doesn't look like everybody else. Right. Like Rachel and I are engineers because we're women. Most people remember our names.
Yes.
You know, like they know Mandy and Rachel, but they don't know the five different Toms. Right. Like, I just,
yeah.
I do think it's funny that we're 100% engineers on this podcast.
Yes. I love it.
Who's next?
Well, unless we want it to be like 12 hours long, yeah. We should probably just go to Father Pruitt and
excellent.
Use that to wrap everything together.
Let's briefly talk about a couple of other folks because okay. it would be wrong to not talk about Joe Colley and Lisa and the most powerful scene
that's fair.
In the show.
Yeah.
Just bawling during that scene.
Oh, I know.
When she says, "You stole from me, you stole from the future, you reached through time." And stole from you.
Not just what I am, but what I could be.
So much power. Yeah. Yep.
And then the forgiveness in there too, right? It is beautiful, and that leads to him going to confession, and then going to AA, right? And so you have this, and this is what's so galling about the way Bev treats him after he dies. She refers to him as it.
Yeah.
And she refers to him as he was an awful reprobate sinner. Well, no, he had just gone to confession, had just been absolved.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not really the way he was. She's not seeing him the way that he was trying to be. She was seeing him the way a judgy person would see.
Yeah. Joe says to Riley, you know, here's to becoming different people.
Yeah.
You know, when they were walking together. And that's the power. I mean, redemption's the whole point of you know, Jesus, you know, coming to us and stuff. And Bev's not going to accept that.
Yeah.
But Joe, that's a good character. But that scene with them two in the trailer, Lisa and Joe, was so very good. I know that's what you guys are talking about.
And the actor for Joe, you know, he barely says anything. He's just reacting to what Lisa says.
And I remember his reaction when he opens the door and he recoils in horror.
Yeah.
It's almost like, is that a vampire, you know?
Yes.
But it's not. It's Lisa, you know, and Lisa walks through the door. The director was perfect there because he didn't show her walking up, you know. He kept on Joe and he recoiled and then she walks in.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And I do want to say, I think one of the differences between Lisa and her parents and their susceptibility to the cult, if you will, I feel like Lisa's parents were praying every day for a miracle. And I feel like Lisa at some point had accepted what had happened to her. She wasn't happy about it, but I don't feel like she was at mass every morning praying for a miracle. I feel like she was there trying to accept what had happened to her in life and, you know, feel God and be close to him. But it becomes very clear when her parents talk about all of the like medical bills, all the things they've done, that they are hoping for a miracle. And then Father Pruitt gives it to them. And then he could have done no wrong. Right. Yeah, like they were going to follow him to the end of the earth. Whereas Lisa, who's the one who got the miracle, doesn't. Right. She's the one who she doesn't drink and her parents can't make her. it's crazy.
It is crazy. Yeah.
And, you know, at the very end of the show, right, it's her and Warren in that boat. And she says, "I can't feel my legs." And you can see the relief on her face. Essentially says whatever bad stuff had been happening is now gone and I'm back to, you know, the miracle was nice, but not at that cost.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. And you mentioned that Riley's parents were susceptible to the cult and then, but at the end they saw, you know, they were like, this isn't right.
Yeah. You get that great line from Dad. I'm still just going to call him Dad or Henry. There we go. It doesn't change who you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Riley's parents are really interesting because I think they are our example of actual true believers, right?
Yes.
They are people who struggle with their faith because Riley's dad clearly struggles with his anger, right? Mm-hmm. And his inability to forgive Riley. But he still believes, right? Mm-hmm. Riley's mom, she's just so solid throughout the whole thing, right? Like, it doesn't matter what happens. She is just true to herself and trying to do what's best for God and her family and her community. And that's why at the end, they're the ones who accept that they need to die, right? Yeah. And start singing and take this terrible, dark moment and make it that they end their lives praising God. Like, just like the power of that ending scene. And it's they are not afraid of death. Like, unlike, you know, the other actors who are making things happen, they're not afraid of what's to come, right? And I mean, to a certain extent, they know that one of their sons is safe, right? Or they hope. Actually, that's just faith. They don't know he's safe. Yeah. They have faith, right? And it's so beautiful. Like, I get to the end and I want to cry every time. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who bring the community back to God, not the priest, not the woman who's, you know, like his second in command, not the altar boy, not the organist, not the mayor. It is these essentially nobodies in the town, right? Like, and it's beautiful.
It is beautiful. You know, you can look at some of the history of the Catholic Church too, and that's sort of who kept it going, you know, were those kinds of people, you know, through some of the bad periods. That's what kept things going.
Any of the other sort of, they're not even minor characters. All the characters are important. Mm-hmm. Rachel, we haven't heard from you in a while. Anything you want to talk about anyone other than Father Pruitt?
I don't know. I think we covered a lot about Lisa, and I love Annie Flynn. Like, I think she's probably one of my favorite characters. And
that's Mom.
Yes, that's Mom. I just like seeing her. She's like the representation of like the father in the story of the prodigal son. Like, Riley comes home and she doesn't care what he did. Mm-hmm. Like, she just accepts him and like she does everything she can to keep the family together. She's just very like, oh yeah, just come, like, your room's in here, sorry, your dad's storing stuff in here, or oh, your dad just walked out, instead of just like, yeah, your dad doesn't want to talk to you. Like, she's, I don't know, right. She's, I love that she does her best to keep her family together and how she loves Riley regardless of what he did. I also liked I love her rant to Bev, telling her she's not a nice person, not a good person, and mm-hmm. calling her out on all of the stuff that she's done. That it just bugs her that God loves other people as much as he loves her. But I also like to kind of go back to what Mandy was saying about the townspeople and their singing. Like, it's just such a stark difference between what they do versus like what Bev is doing at the exact same time. So you have these people who are literally praising God until their dying breath, because that's what they want. Like, that's part of their faith. And then Bev is frantically on the beach, like digging, trying to hide from the sun. Like, it's just the contrast between them is so striking. And it kind of reminded me of that verse. I can't remember if it's in, I'm not like Bev. I can't just rattle off like scriptures, but that pride comes before a fall.
Half the Bible.
Yeah. Like, right. I don't know, looking at her, I'm like, oh, this is like, this should have been in your head.
It reminded me of the verses in Revelation, right? Say to the hills, fall on us, protect us from the wrath of the, of the Lord.
Yeah.
The, one thing I like about the rant to Bev is that it kind of nicely subverts. She has her Bev moment when Aaron comes and says that Riley's dead, and she won't accept it. And mm-hmm. that's her character's low point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Where she shoves Aaron.
Yeah.
And then
I feel too like much that's, to take. That, yeah.
It brings her back around when she says that to Bev.
Yeah. And she feels bad about it.
fun fact about Kristen Lehman, who plays Annie, is she was part of the cast of Forever Night, which is a vampire show.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh.
In the '90s. So.
So I think we haven't talked about the Gunnings, but I think that's okay, because I think we'll talk about them with Father Pruitt, because
I think we can't escape that, talking about them with Father Pruitt.
No.
Okay, let's talk about Father Paul / Monsignor Pruitt.
Yes. Indeed. So
real quick for Scott, Monsignor is just not a bishop.
Nope. But
higher than just a priest.
Yeah, it's more of an honorific title.
Okay.
You know, it's not a real position. That's my understanding.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't run into a lot of Monsignors. But there are some.
Does that mean they're like more old school? Like, I was wondering if that was just
It could be, but it is a title. It is a title that they're given. But my understanding is it's pretty much an honorific. I'm not even certain who would give that. But there's no other duties or anything. Yeah, that's my understanding. I may be short on that.
Certainly, it's not a big chair to fill on that island.
Exactly. No. I mean, there's not a Monsignor in every town or something like that. You know, so I know there was a Monsignor down at the cathedral here in Utah. I don't think there is right now. He was there for a while. But I think it's just a title. I don't know that it comes with any duties or anything like that. So we have we have priests, bishops, Pope is the head bishop. Right. Then we have cardinals and
archbishops. Just more important bishops.
Yeah, exactly right. And an archbishop is just over more of a bigger area or a bigger community.
Well, and a cathedral is a seat of a bishop, right?
Yeah.
Cathedral means chair.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You bet.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Learn something new every day.
that's why when they speaking ex cathedra, right, means speaking from the seat.
From the seat, right.
The seat of Peter. Right?
Mm-hmm. You know, and I took 4 years of Latin, and I didn't know that. So, you know.
You bet. Nice. So
Father Pruitt. First off, I have questions. He gets sent to the Holy Land on this tour, right? And he's clearly having problems. He runs into a vampire. He comes back younger. What did the tour think that happened to him?
It's right. A good question.
Like, oh, Father Pruitt wandered into the desert.
Yeah.
So it goes.
Like,
that's a little hole right there. Yeah.
And my other question is, how did he get back through customs with his original passport? But you have to accept that.
I kind of get the impression that he more or less made his way back to the New World. Like, what is the name of the ship in Dracula?
Oh, yeah.
The Demeter.
Right.
Is that kind of thing. Because he's got the big trunk like they have on the Demeter. But yeah. I don't know.
A trunk of vampire.
Yeah. Which ship do I take if I've got a vampire in a box?
Exactly. Do I have to declare a vampire at customs? So
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have to assume that in this world there is actually no vampire mythology. Like that's
no one
what
ever
I
uses
assume.
The word, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So he's never met something like this. But despite that, I can only attribute it to his state of mind and that he was made young, that you don't look at this leathery, bat-winged creature and think devil.
Right.
Well, I know, you know, in the Bible, every time we see an angel, there's like, hey, don't be afraid, you know. So it's like, you know, whatever an angel looks like has got to be unsettling, or just the presence has got to be overwhelming or something. But they always say, I mean, even to Mary, to be not afraid, you know.
Yes.
So I've got something to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I always assume that in Mary's case, you know, even if Gabriel looked like a normal guy, he basically Star Trek beamed into her room.
Yeah, right.
So that would be scary.
That would be scary. That would be scary. And in the Bible, it says that that Satan, let's see, how is it put? Something about Satan
masquerades as an angel
of light. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, so I imagine that Pruitt, especially in the state he was in when he first met that thing, was very susceptible to suggestion, you know. So it's like, this is good. You know, what's happening here is good. And we can do more good. And somehow that sunk in all the way down.
Well, and he clearly says at the end that the thing he was thinking of when he's made young was Millie and Sarah.
Yeah.
Right. And bringing this miracle of youngness back to his true love. Right.
Right.
Which is very interesting. So what I think is interesting about Father Pruitt is I feel like he tells us two stories about himself that explain almost everything he did. Is one, he tells us that his sister died when he was young and it made him afraid of death. And that's why he joined the church. Cause he was looking to find an answer to his fear of death and to not be afraid. The other story he tells us is about Riley, and to Riley is about a mouse. And he fakes a resurrection to extend Riley's belief. So he's okay doing something false to extend Riley's belief, when if he had just been more honest with Riley, that would have given Riley probably a solider foundation in his faith, right?
Ends and means, right.
Yes. So Father Pruitt is clearly willing to do whatever it takes to bring about what he thinks is how things should be, which I don't think he's insincere in his faith. I think he believes in God, and I think he means to be a good leader. But I think these things are the flaws in his character that allow him to end up where he ends up in the end.
Yep. Love it.
He lies very easily for a priest, too. I found that very surprising.
Yeah.
Someone comes in and he'll just like, oh, this is what happened. And I'm like, what? that was cool. You were cool as a cucumber as you said that. That is definitely not happening.
Doesn't need to pause.
Yeah.
But I like, you know, what Mandy said there about, you know, him having the end in mind would make it easy for him to lie. If he's just thinking this is all for the greater good, you know, then he's in his head. He's just like, you know, anybody else.
Right. Right. Well, he's been lying for decades. You have to assume that he never confessed.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. Right. As far as who his daughter is, right? He has been lying for decades and decades. Yeah.
Good point. You presume that he was having an ongoing affair with Millie. Like, that's the impression I get, right? This wasn't a one-off that they accidentally got pregnant on, right? This was, he views her as the love of his life, that he's willing to do anything for. So an ongoing sin that he never confesses, never, like not even at the end of the show, right? He, at the end of the show, he says what we did wasn't wrong. This is a sin he's not willing to give up. Because he says that he can't say that Sarah was wrong. But once again, that's kind of going about it the wrong way, right? God can use anything and create goodness from anything. So Sarah can be good and a good thing. But that doesn't mean that it didn't, a sin didn't, you know, happen.
Mm. Right. Yeah. And he's clearly a little delusional too about what their prospects were, because Millie says to him, I was never going to leave them.
Right.
I was never going to run away with you. And I do, my one of my favorite lines is, you know, he's trying to give them a second chance. And she says, we were supposed to fade away. That's the way it's supposed to be. And then our kids are supposed to go on after us. And now what we've done is perverse.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always think it's interesting. Like, I feel like as a congregant, you would know he's going off the rails at the Good Friday sermon, right? That's the sermon that Millie basically walks out of and says, you are not allowed to go back to that church.
Yep. The army, right?
Yes. I don't think it's wrong to say that we're an army of God, army doing good. But the way he goes about it, what he starts talking about is you will do terrible things in God's name. And it's your conscience that'll drive you. And like, he's justifying himself killing Joe, and that, you know, he sets them up for the murder spree that's going to happen. Right.
Yes.
And it's just like, I mean, I was like, I don't know who I was talking to, but I was like, I don't know if this is a Catholic thing or a small town thing or me just being me. But if I had been in that sermon, I would have stood up and said, what is going on? Mm-hmm. Like I, considering how small the congregation is, right? Like, I can get sometimes when you're in like a crowd of like 1,000, like it's weird to stand up and call the pastor out. But when you're talking about like a congregation of like 50 people, I would have been like, this is like blasphemy.
Yeah. What are
like,
you doing?
It's at least heresy.
At some point, he even says like, God's will changes. Like, and it's like, no, that's not true. No, right. So I think that goes along with like heresy and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's really interesting is that his idea of a new covenant is Islam, as the sheriff was describing it earlier, right? Which is, you know, that, you know, we were given the Torah and then, you know, it got infected, the wrong word, but it got
corrupted.
Distorted.
Corrupted. Mm-hmm. And then we got the New Testament and it got corrupted. So then we were given a New Testament, a new Testament, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is all straight out of the cult handbook, right?
Yeah.
This is what you do. You say those old scriptures are good. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it's just like, yes, he has gone off the rails. That Good Friday sermon should have been the sermon that alerted everyone that something was happening. And you can see like the Flynns are like confused, but they're not going to say anything. Right.
I thought that was great. You know, they kept showing audience members or congregants and, you search in their face to find, what do they think of this? What do they think of this? You know, and some of them were clearly uncomfortable. Some of them were nodding, you know, like the mayor. He's like, yeah, this sounds right to me. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah.
It's probably worth mentioning. I mean, we shouldn't finish this episode without talking about some of the political commentary here, because clearly you have, it's there, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have the rise of an idea that brings a certain group of people into power and they're willing to compromise on their morals and get behind someone who's clearly immoral to do that. And
right.
I'm not going to name names. everybody knows what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But
again, it's the ends and the means, right?
It is. Yeah. Where Bev is like the political establishment that's supporting this evil person.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think evil is a strong word for Father Pruitt, right? I think he's bad. I think he makes bad decisions. I don't think he has malintent, if you will. I think he is a man who is afraid of death, who is trying to save some people, who wants to rejuvenate his community as he was rejuvenated. He's certainly heretical. He's certainly off the rails, but I don't think he's intending to do bad, but he creates a scenario where bad can flourish. And I think that if Millie hadn't shot him, things would have gone differently that night if he had stayed in control. I don't think it would have been good, in fact, because they probably then would have continued vampirism and not conquered it all that night.
Right.
But I think we wouldn't have seen the same murder spree.
Bev ran away with it at that point, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And, you know, Sturge even says, like, he said to keep the doors closed. And, you know, Bev is like, nope, open them up. Let everybody out. Do what your conscience leads you to do, which is just murderize everyone, I guess, and then regret it afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. And Pruitt, you know, he's convinced himself of the goodness of what he's doing, and just despite the evidence right in front of him. And I think that's a human quality unfortunately we all share at some extent or another, you know, presented with factual information and unable to change.
I think if anyone else had found him after he killed Joe and been like horrified, I think it would have put him back on the path of like, something's off here.
That's
right?
A good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he ultimately comes out of it and says, this is wrong. We did wrong. This is, this is not the way this should have gone. And that's when Bev disowns him.
Yeah.
Right. He's no longer useful to her.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's him seeing Bev reject people coming to them at the end, because he's like, the doors are open, everyone should come to God and vampirism, and Bev is like, no, I'm gonna be a super Presbyterian. I say this as I go to a Presbyterian church, so this is a joke, and I'm gonna have only the chosen, right, and the rest of you are condemned.
Which is funny, you know, that she threw the doors open, or you know, because she's been closing the doors the whole show, and then, I mean, mentally or metaphorically, and then she throws the doors open to let everybody out. You know, let's open these doors.
To spread the good news.
Exactly. That's right. That's right.
To spread the good news that's not even thought through, because, like, you know, how old do you have to be to go through First Communion in the Catholic Church, right? So 2-year-olds are just going to be murdered. Like,
They can be brought back. Right.
Oh, yes, I guess you can bring them back if you're thinking of that and not just tearing them limb to limb.
Exactly. Right. Which does happen.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I also wonder if this is her way of like purging the island of the non-believers or whatever. Like, yeah, go out, wreak havoc, get rid of everybody who's horrible. Yes. Like, and anybody who doesn't go to church in my view is horrible. Yeah. So yes, go. Because it kind of goes with how she was treating Joe, like calling him an it. When his corpse is lying, there's like, go take it, put it, like bury it or whatever. Like, I think that kind of shows this was her way of like getting back at everyone on the island that she doesn't think is righteous or whatever.
I also wonder about Millie and Father Pruitt's relationship, right? Because he gives this terrible sermon on Good Friday and she storms out and says, we're never going to go back there. But she doesn't confront him, right? Which makes it seem like, I don't know, she doesn't have a level of familiarity with him that he can take with her. And that could be, you know, just like levels of authority there because he's both a priest and a man. It could be because she doesn't feel like she can approach him in broad daylight because they have this ongoing shame, you know, whatever it is. But you would think that if they are really the equals, the soulmates that Father Pruitt is convinced they are, that her first thought after that would be to confront him. Because if my husband said something like that, I would be like, excuse you.
Yeah.
Right. Like, what is going on here? But she's clearly not comfortable enough to do that. Her answer is we cannot go back there. And so it just makes me wonder about the dynamics of their relationship. And the only time she stands up to him is when she shoots him. And then after that, she's just kind of like, her presence makes him feel, there's a church word I'm looking for, conviction. Mm-hmm. But she does not directly convict him, right? She does not call him out. It's just her actions convict him.
Did you guys notice, on a fun note, did you guys notice the poster of Annabeth Gish in Riley's bedroom from X-Files?
Oh, I noticed that.
I did notice an X-Files poster, yes, but I couldn't tell who it was.
Yeah, and there was an Annabeth Gish from the X-Files on his wall, and she plays Sarah Gunning.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize she was in the X-Files.
She was at the very end. It was brief, I think.
Oh, that was the season. Because I was like, that doesn't look like Scully. Yeah. Like, I'm like sitting there staring at the poster like, it's an X-Files poster, but it doesn't look like Scully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's interesting, too, because is she playing the, you know, Scully was the more skeptical character there, and she definitely has that role here, right? Where she's not religious, she's a scientist, and she's approaching the contagion as a contagion, not as a miracle.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, another kind of, I don't know if it's ever clear if she's an atheist or an agnostic or just a, you know, very science-minded person. But she, like Riley, is just another perspective, right? She's like, she's skeptical of everything that's going on. Obviously, she's a lesbian, which has influenced her experience in the church.
Right.
And because Father Pruitt was always creeping on her, that also influenced her experience with the church, even though he wasn't creeping on her for the reasons she thought.
Right.
But,
that was a nice touch. Yeah. They're in that Ash Wednesday party, which was an odd thing as a Catholic, too. You know, Ash Wednesday is a feast or a fast day. So I've never had a potluck on Ash Wednesday, you know.
Yeah, you would have thought that would have been on Tuesday.
It would have been on Tuesday, exactly. That's the party day, and then it's very somber on Ash Wednesday. You're not going to get the band together and go to the park. But that scene with her and her girlfriend, and then the priest, you know, watching her, I just thought that was a nice touch. It's like, yeah, he's always looking at me. You know, you get that feeling, then that was just a clue that he was just very interested in her, just not for the reasons, like you said, that she thought, you know, like, which was, she wasn't being condemned by him or chased by him. She, you know, it's like, yeah, you're my daughter. So, just nice touch.
Yeah, he says to her when he first passes out in church and then she's tending to him and he, when he's speaking to her, he says, you know, I'm proud of you.
Mm.
Right.
And it's a very odd thing for this young priest to say to her when he's only been here a short time.
Right.
Also very patronizing, right? Like if you're not someone who goes to the church and this young priest tells you they're proud of you, you're like, what?
That's weird. That's so very odd.
I was surprised on this viewing to notice how soon you actually see Father Paul. Because he's there on the ferry when Riley comes back.
Yeah.
It's just in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so well constructed to have that there for people to catch on subsequent viewings.
Yeah.
And, you know, the episode where he's doing his confession, and it's interesting because he's telling the story of what happened in Israel, and it's going through these. Scott, is there a particular name? Are they icons or? Cuts or I don't know what they are.
Oh, I think you were looking. So those things are Stations of the Cross. But they had different images on them. So every yes. church has these stations, you know, of the Passion of Christ. And that's normally, there's lots of different forms those can have. But that's what I got those. But they were his story, right? So you can, you know, liken it to the Passion of Christ, which would be the illusion there.
Yeah. Okay.
Awesome.
Well, we have been going for a while here, and we didn't really ever talk about all the different uses of scriptures, misuses of scriptures that are done in this. And I want to make sure we get any final questions for Scott about Catholic practice, because certainly mixing an angel's or a demon blood, vampire blood into the communion wine would render
that it normally invalid, doesn't happen.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Just to be clear, that's frowned upon. Very frowny. Very frowny.
I mean, you have to use proper form and proper matter, right? Yeah. It has to be wine. And I think you can add some water to it.
Yeah, but they always do add a little water to it. Yeah.
But certainly adding blood to it, I would think, would render it invalid. There's so much scripture, especially by Bev, right? Using and perverting for her cause, right? Where Sturge comes in, or maybe it's the mayor. I think it's Sturge reacting to Joe's death, saying, this isn't right. And she smacks him across the face and says, you know, the man who is disrespectful to the priest shall be liable to death or something from, I just read that in Deuteronomy this week. And like, I don't think that's applicable in Catholicism. I think that was in the old covenant.
I like that she takes the God role, you know, who are you to question me? You know, like in Job.
Well, and there's all the Revelation verses too, as they're burning down the town, right?
Yeah.
The angel poured out its wrath and his blood and fire, right?
Yep.
I mean, Bev is the example of that proof texter who's just going to pull anything from the Bible and take it incredibly out of context to make her point.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk about before we, I'll move into sort of summing up here, and I'll just go first and be a bad host. When you look at this all as a cult, right, people are susceptible to it in different ways and at different times, but then so many of them come out of it, but it takes different events for that to happen, like Annie and Dad. They're immediately turned off by the, you know, drinking of the poison and that kind of stuff and sacrifice themselves and then never attack anyone, whereas Sturge, you know, goes in whole hog, the mayor goes in whole hog, and the other altar boy does as well, right? Whereas Lisa and Warren escape unscathed from that. But I did like that moment when Sturge goes over to the other altar boy and says, I done some things, kid, will you forgive me? You know, and like it took a long time for them to come out of that, but then ultimately under the leadership of Annie and Dad joins in with the singing of Nearer My God to Thee. And it's beautiful the way it ends. I just think it's wonderful. So hand it off to somebody else who wants to give a kind of final summing up.
I just think it's just a terrific show. It's a rare show. Again, like we said at the beginning, these conversations are very thought provoking and respectful, I would say, you know, giving more than one side of things. And Riley's journey from feeling he has no purpose at all to strength, you know, I felt was extremely worthwhile and great. And and what we talked about, the show being about suffering and the fear of death, you know, those things come up over and over and over in here. And you guys have opened my eyes to some of them that I didn't even see. So, but thank you. I just really... This is a top-notch show, and if anybody hasn't seen it, has listened this long and hasn't seen it, you know, please do. But I'm looking forward to exploring some more of Mike Flanagan's stuff too. I haven't seen the other two miniseries on Netflix, but I have seen some of his movies. And thanks again for having me here.
Yeah, definitely. It's a pleasure to have you. And everybody make sure to check out A Good Story Is Hard to Find.
Thanks.
Well, I also want to echo thank you for inviting me to do this. This is really fun. I'm sorry about all the technical difficulties. But I guess final thoughts on the show is that I love this show. I think it's so well done. It's so deep. I feel like every time I watch it, I find something new that I didn't notice before. And talking about it with you guys kind of opened up some new things as well. I just love the different perspectives it gives and the discussions that it opens up. And yeah, I echo what has been said before. If you haven't seen it yet, you should go see it and see what else you can find when you watch it.
Yeah, I honestly don't know how Mike Flanagan's going to top this one. you know, all of his other works are adaptions. So this is like his one true original work, which is not, you know what I mean? Original work in a, it's not an adaption sense.
Right.
And it's so good. And like I said, I want it to be a book so I can just live in it and like zone out the whole world and just read and there'd be even more depth. Like I wish it was an adaptation of a book he had written.
Yeah, me too.
So I could, yeah, I could just get more. But I think it's perfect as it is. I love, you know, you had mentioned earlier, Seth, that it's 7 episodes, and I think that's perfect. I think, you know, it's a situation where because he had done so well with Netflix, I feel like they gave him a blank check and they were probably like 8 episodes, 10 episodes. And he was like, no, I wrote it out and I need 7. And I'm not going to extend it because the show needs to be 7 episodes. And there's a lot of shows that suffer from being extended longer than they should be.
For certain.
So, you know, whether you're a Christian or an atheist or, you know, I hope the Muslim position is represented well in this. I feel like it is, but, you know, I'm not a Muslim and I haven't talked to any Muslims about it, but it feels at least sincere. And so I feel like everyone's positions are well represented. And it just comes together into this beautiful story of the human condition, right? Mm-hmm. And about faith and cults. don't drink the Kool-Aid, children. I love it, and I will inevitably rewatch it again.
One thing that I had, I can't remember where I saw it mentioned, was that in all the times when it shows Ali and Sheriff Hassan praying, Hassan is on the left, and that's the position of the person who's leading the prayer. But at the very end, when they're on the beach, Ali is on the left. Oh. And I thought that was a really nice touch, if that's really true. Nice. And I don't know.
Yeah.
But but everybody do make sure to check out Trivial or Crucial as well. You have quite a back catalog, actually. So even if it's lain fallow for a while, there's a lot of good episodes there.
I think we have like 50 episodes. Cool. But it's been a while. Life has gotten in the way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Understood. And like I said, I will record with Michael for a couple months from now, probably bonus episode, just to catch up with him and the cool stuff that he's been doing. So, well, thank you, Mandy. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Rachel. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And to anybody who's listening, you know, check out those podcasts and also let us know what did you think of this series? If you're, for instance, not a Christian, I think there's still a lot to chew on in this series. And I'd love to hear from you. Okay. Well, thanks again, everybody. Bye-bye.